So this is our free discussion. Open discussion, sorry, I don't... It's what it says on the menu. So I can't remember what we do every year in this, but this is the bit where we can say what we like. Okay, but let's try and keep it on topic.
Okay. You mean anything we like?
No. It's the themes in metaphysics, right? So try and stay on the agenda. I don't mind a little bit of epistemology, but try and keep to metaphysics. Okay. So does anybody want to say anything burning?
Are we not allowed to ask questions of the speakers?
Yeah, ask questions of the speakers. Speak up. So,
burning is what they would have done to Leibniz.
I mean, do we still have anybody here who thinks metaphysics is a load of rubbish? Because it would be really... Oh, Bill. Come on then. Would you like to state the point of view of the person?
Dave Wolfe.
Dave Wolfe?
I'm sure he still thinks.
Is he still here?
Could I ask a question after that?
Yeah. So who would like... Thurman.
Can I ask? Do you think that the main problem which is addressed in metaphysics is the binding problem, which is the creation of one entity from the multiplicity of entities?
Now,
could you repeat that, please?
Do you think that...
Let me repeat that, which is, do you think that the main problem of metaphysics is the binding problem, which is the problem of how one entity comes from a multiplicity of entities?
Right? Yeah. So I think Mike is the first person, because he used the word binding in his talk.
I don't understand the question.
Well, Mike's going to explain the question and the answer.
It certainly is a considerable part of the problem, yes, insofar as... we tend to think about the world too thoroughly in either reductionist or anti-reductionist manner. Either it's reducible down to quantum mechanics micro-banging, as Lederman calls it, or we just reject that altogether and say, no, nothing is reducible. Whereas, in fact, we should take, I think, a lesson from Leibniz, probably should pass on to David, in that a lot of what we call entities are in fact structures. And it is structures are in fact relations between other entities going down to the fundamental level which may or may not exist. But essentially what I'm trying to say is it's the structures and the relationship which form structures which is how you form entities.
And we end up with an entity.
Yeah.
We end up with an entity, whatever happens.
The further we
go down, we always come to an entity.
We don't match.
Which either is or isn't analyzable. Sorry.
The question is whether at the bottom we always wind up with an entity which is either is or is not analyzable. That is currently a burning issue, curiously enough, in physics, and is beginning to be also a burning question in some of philosophy, I understand, where the suggestion is that perhaps what we have at the very bottom is not entity, but information. Now, exactly what that means, actually, that's a very open question. I would like to know more about that.
Charles is...
Sorry, can I query the word structure and say models, not structures?
Emergence?
You don't need it.
Think what? I don't need it, apparently. That can shout. No, I don't think you could. Take, for example, the clusters of cows in genetic space. They're not really models. They are only models it depends on what do you mean by models.
I mean all that we have access to is our models of the world.
Yeah.
We don't have access to the real world. So when we talk about genetic space, we're really talking about a model we've created to try and explain the world.
Yeah.
So we're talking about structures. All we're really talking about is models we have to attempt to explain the world. So we don't really ever have access to the real world. We only have access to the perceptions and the models we've created of it.
Some philosophers, at least I think, would quarrel with that on the grounds that there is the belief that we have direct access to our mental states, whatever that might mean, or at least to mental phenomena. I wouldn't, personally. No, certainly not. Whether or not it's a tenable position, I would argue against it, but I cannot disprove it, let's put it this way.
But those two positions are consistent, aren't they?
They are, yes.
Because what you're saying is that we never access the world as it is in itself. What we access is our beliefs about the world.
Yeah.
So we all our beliefs are a model of the world, but if we might have direct access to our beliefs about the world,
which in itself
but of course
structures.
Our beliefs are real, they are part of the world.
So just to give you an example, one of the classic issues in philosophy is the question of spectrum inversion. What happens if we invert perception of somebody's so that you get to the inverse spectrum? And the answer to that is, well, that depends. Are you also inverting all the relationships between colors or not?
I think it's category error.
The
problem disappears.
Yeah, exactly. But only if you invert all the relationships.
If you trying to keep it all here. So, you want to follow? Yeah. So, Charles and then the gentleman there. I can't remember your name.
Just to pick up that point about the model, model is fine there, but a better word is hypothesis. When we're talking about structure, a better explanation of structure is relations between the parts. So that if you have as Mike was trying to say, if we go down and keep going down, we find that an object, if you examine it closely, what you're seeing in fact isn't the object in quotation marks. What you're seeing is the relations between the parts of that object, not the total parts of that object.
Relations between the hypotheses.
No, the hypothesis is what your brain generates. When you see the relation between the parts, what comes back through your eyes and so on, isn't a very accurate presentation of that desk or whatever over there, because that is essentially a three-dimensional thing. What comes back, in fact, is a two-dimensional thing. Your brain then processes those two dimensions and tries to make a full three-dimensional hypothesis out of them. It can't, so it ends up with what we call 2.5. But it's enough to be getting on with. But the point is, what your brain, in fact, has, your brain hasn't perceived the total structure, the total relation between the parts of that particular object. What it has done is perceive part of the information coming from that thing.
It's creating a working model that's not to go on with.
But the hypothesis is always going to be less than the whole truth. In other words, the whole actual information about the total relation between the parts.
Because to have the whole truth, you'd have to have an entirely a perfect model of the universe.
Yes, but not only that, but the information coming in is less than the whole information that is available. So your brain has to infer. It has to infer, for example, that lectern over there is a three-dimensional object, right? Which, as far as the brain's concerned, the information coming in is a two-dimensional thing. So what the brain has to do is to build up the best hypothesis it can construct out of it. But that hypothesis is almost always going to be less than 100% accurate.
Well, I think, aren't we're agreed that many statements are hypothetical or conjectural, but in the metaphysical aspect of things, what we're trying to do is to classify all the different things that are being referred to in the hypotheses.
Yes, but
also the way that we revise those hypotheses.
Yes, when you start to go, instead of going up to the brain making a hypothesis, you carry on down the lecture and what the lecture is made of and so on. And you find that each case, you never come to the object. Somebody mentioned earlier on Lehmann and Rossi's book, which is entitled
Everything Must Go.
Yeah. And that's literally
metaphysics naturalize.
You never come to things. What you come to, in fact, is
information.
Things that have passed. What you see is the relations between the parts of that thing. And if you could go on further, the parts, of course, if it's a relation between the parts, the next thing down is the relata.
Yeah.
And of course, if you could take that step further down, again you're into relations. So all you go all the way down is you have relations, whatever is essentially abstract. You never, ever get into contact with anything that we could seriously call matter.
I'd like to argue with that, but I need to give this segment a chance to speak.
I was going to make precisely that point, because I think we're making a mistake thinking of the universe as we see it as consisting solely of matter, whereas the argument going on these days, as far as I understand it, that the universe consists solely of information, and that the whole of the universe is its own simulator in that sense. So the universe contains all the information of itself. So, in talking about tables and things, it's in many ways misleading. You should talk about the information that describes the table.
Yeah, and if you look at metaphysics, that looking at the world entirely made of information is one of the ways of looking at the world, which that they have in their classification of ways of classifying things.
If I can just pencil
and it's very like Barclay, is it not?
Just let me pencil that for another couple of seconds.
Ooh.
The point of information here is, yes, that's absolutely right. One of the problems that we have right now is that we don't really understand as much about information as we want to do. In other words, if you ask, what is information? You find now that at the forefront of philosophy, now that linguistic philosophy has more or less run its course, there isn't much more new than it's got to teach us. The next thing that needs looking after is, among other things, one of them is information. And you find now that there is the next logical step in philosophy is being put out. There's a guy called Luciano Floridi who's done all the work on this, and he's putting out now that the universe is essentially informational, made of informational.
Well, that's a very important point of view, but let's give, I think Bob needs to say something, so we need to pass the phone.
To be real, for a thing to be real, this is really interesting, this comes from Lehmann and so on, for a thing to be real, it has to be not redundant in the total informational structure of the universe. Very interesting.
Yeah, well, pass it over to Bob there.
Basically, I feel unsympathetic to everything that's been said in the last 5 minutes.
Good. Come on then.
First of all, it seems to me there's this information thing is unfamiliar to me, but information must be about something. Information must be about something other than just itself. And I'd be very interested to know what the information that is the basis of everything is about. But that's a sign which you haven't really looked at before. In the sense of this hypothesis we make, if I look at the lecture, the hypothesis I have is that I have direct perceptual access to that lecture. And I realise that it's a hypothesis, and that it may be a very clever two-dimensional drawing, or I may even be imagining it altogether. But nonetheless, part of my hypothesis is not that I'm having direct access to the hypothesis, but that I'm having direct access to the lectern. That seems to be a fundamental point, and that the lectern, if I'm right, is real. I don't see how anyone can possibly question the fact that the lectern is real.
In
the normal sense in which the English word real is used, which is the only sense which is the middle. I mean, it may not be the fundamental constituent of the universe, if that's a scientific question. But in the normal sense, the lectern is real, whereas if I shut my eyes and imagine a lectern about 2 feet away on my left, that's not real.
Not an illusion.
Maybe wrong, maybe the lectern isn't illusion. But the perfectly good English sense in which that lectern is real, and the one I'm imagining in the other corner
dangerous
is an illusion. But it's a dangerous word, but it's got a perfectly good English sense. It seems to me if we're going to start using it in sort of technical senses, we're going to lose touch with the language reality of speaking. That's really my plea, that we use words in the way that they've been used by
do
English
you
people.
Believe it consists of matter?
I have no idea.
And what you said to the question,
that's a scientific question, what I really mean. Yeah, I do care deeply, but it's a scientific question, not the sort of thing I could answer. But as an ordinary person, I think I'm entitled as a professor of physics to know the difference between what's real and what isn't.
Anybody got anything to say in reply to that? I know Patrick's going to be next. But are you replying to that, or you want to start a new strand?
Let's have a new strand.
Well, this
okay.
It is a little bit about that. Some of the terms that Bob was questioning, like information, sometimes used as a technical way, actually. But I'm just going to think about. I think for me, metaphysics is part of philosophy. It's more than just the transmission of information. It's not like science in that way. So there is a sense. And I'm surprised that I find myself saying this in a way, but there is a sense in belief in that I'm coming around to the conclusion, and I'd like to hear other people what they think about this, but belief systems of the world are actually just as real as objective furniture of the world, if you like. I've needed quite a long time to actually go into that, but I think that at the moment, I feel that some people are saying that belief systems are not as real, if you like, as, say, the lectern on there. But I think there is an argument to be made for the fact that the belief systems are as real as the lectern on the thing.
So here's a question for you. Although I'm chairing, I'm still allowed to say something, aren't I? Many of us would agree that beliefs are one of the objects of the world. You know, it's out there. It is real. I wouldn't deny it. The question I would ask you, is it ontologically fundamental or is it reducible to something else? So that becomes the metaphysical question. Do you think that beliefs are ontologically right at the bottom there, or do you believe they're somewhere further up? So that will be the question. Not whether they're real, but whether they actually have constituent parts or whether they're ultimate.
Are you making an assumption?
Asking a question.
Are you making an assumption that there is more value to be put in the most foundational?
No, there's no question of value. I mean, I don't believe I'm ontologically fundamental. I know I'm made out of chemicals. I know that essentially, for a fact. I might be made out of other things as well, but I know that I'm not ontologically fundamental. So there's no value associated with it.
The belief is ontologically. What the belief is about may not be.
Yeah. Is it reducible? Mike's got his hand up. That's the way we play it. Put your hand up if you want to say something with the mic. And I'm the only one who's allowed to talk without a mic, right?
Just to respond to Bob, not only to Bob, but just a general observation. I think a lot of these discussions are bedeviled by one particular, I hesitate to say confusion, because people tend to take it wrongly as something derogatory, but conflation of two separate ideas. And I took this, strangely enough, from Gödel's series about undecidability, etc. Gödel's great breakthrough was to realize that the truth of a statement is not the same as validity of a statement. That if you insist on analyzing logic in terms of truth and falsehood, you get contradictions. You get no such contradictions if you analyze it in terms of validity and not validity. And I suspect the same thing is happening here. That when we are talking about something is real, etc., we are making the same mistake as claiming that something is as opposed to something is operationally valid. I know it's a controversial view philosophically, but that's my feeling at the moment.
What do you mean by valid? What you're saying is that a statement can be either true or false, or valid or invalid.
That's correct.
What I want to say is we understand what you mean by true or false, or at least I'm assuming we do. What I want to know is what you mean by valid or invalid, it doesn't simply mean true or false.
You've got to allow for the fact that I'm drawing an analogy here, and I can give you the answer, the precise answer, in my starting point, but not in my finishing point, so to speak. Okay? In Gabrielian terms, the validity of a statement simply means this is derivable by proper procedure from other valid statements. Okay? Which does not mean that it is true.
But does it? Okay, so from, I mean, either it's circular because it's
derived from other valid statements.
Or by valid, you mean what I mean by valid, which is that it's an argument that is truth preserving.
It is, yes, correct. That this argument is truth preserving.
In other words, I think the point there.
Do you want a mic? Give him the mic.
I think making a valid statement.
A valid statement is a conclusion that derives from its premises.
Correct.
But it doesn't mean that the premises are correct.
If a
premise is wrong, then it's not true, but it's valid.
That's correct.
So that's just a...
And my point really is that we are necessarily operating on the premises given to us by evolution, by our senses, by our perceptual apparatus, which is the point that Ivo was making.
Yes, but it's arguments that are valid or invalid. Statements are true or false.
That's right.
No, not exactly.
That's how philosophers usually use the two.
But that is precisely what Gödel pointed out is a mistake. Because if Gödel was wrong on this particular one, Gödel was right.
Well, it must have meant something other than what we mean here.
This is a linguistic question.
Speaking philosophically, to be valid is to follow, to be entailed by
an argument, which is something completely different. Can you say it again?
I don't think it's worth the time.
Is that a question? Do ask it.
No, I think it's more worth it than you think. It's already on.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if I remember this after all this long. Is it the case that nouns can be true or false, but processes of the things which can be found? Because the process leads to facts or imputed events. And that can be
I take your point.
It's a difference between a process and a noun.
I understand.
A noun, right?
Yeah.
A noun, yes.
Yeah.
Fact can be a noun, a fact can be true or false.
Chair,
process.
Can't be true or false.
No, a statement about a fact can be true or false. Exactly. The fact itself can't be.
Okay.
But I think the chair needs to stop this one. Mike, can I invite you to submit an article to the review on that topic or volunteer for the Friday discussion or put something on the forum? Okay, the gentleman there.
Does Mike mean that maths can be internally consistent but not true of the world?
That's correct, yes.
That's what Gödel is.
But nobody would deny that. So there must be a misunderstanding.
I'm not saying that anybody denies that. I'm saying that Gödel's insight was exactly truth and validity.
But the separation of truth and validity is absolutely vital, I agree. But it's not that a statement can't be valid.
I don't think that this distinction
It probably should be
not only crucial, but probably should be also carried into the statements about what is. That what
it should be carried into.
I think what you're talking about here is if you have a system of axioms, the axioms you can say of them, are they consistent?
Yeah.
So, and I think we're using the word validity to mean
that's what you're talking about. Yes.
So that's different from truth. So you can have a set of axioms that are valid in the sense of consistent; they don't contradict one another. And then they define a structure. That's what a mathematician is.
I think mathematicians and philosophers I'm pretty sure we agree on that.
Okay, let's move on from that, because it's a bit technical. So now, there are some people here who haven't actually asked any questions. Like, Tegwin, we've got any questions from Wales this year? There must be some. Come all this way. Think about it. Anybody else?
Yes.
Oh, well, Peter hasn't said much. Right, here you go.
Am I on?
You are.
I'm sitting here deeply perturbed, and I just want to tell you why. And it's sort of a metaphysical worry, which is metaphysics is either continuous with science or it's separate from science. So consider metaphysics is separate from science. So presumably that means, what is it? It's either an a priori insight into the truth about the abstract structure of reality, or perhaps more modestly, it's an a priori insight into how human beings think. If it's the first one, it's supposed to be an a priori insight into the structure of absolute reality. It looks as if you've got a lot of metaphysicians all spouting theories that contradict one another, and no one has any notion of how to adjudicate between them.
And on the proper field of physics. And on the proper field of physics?
Well, I'll come to the second one. So if it's the second one, then it seems rather trivial, and it's going to be tied up with human languages, and therefore it's going to be subject to cultural relativism and all sorts of things. So it's not really much of a subject, it's a kind of branch of sociology or something. So if metaphysics is separate from science, then it's sort of hopeless or boring. If it's continuous with science, that looks rather more promising. It's then going to be something like very, very high level science. So you have low-level science, is the gritty stuff, they smash up things in particle accelerators and so on, and you've got sort of people in laboratories and what have you, and then you've got sort of theoretical physicists, and then up above them in this sort of hierarchy are the metaphysicians, who are giving some sort of account of the highly generalized structure that the scientists are discovering. They're trying to give a sort of a very broad view. Now, how about that? Is this a worthwhile activity? But the problem with that is that it precisely that the subject seems to start at with the point where the scientists throw their hands up and say, haven't a clue. Therefore, metaphysics is a complete waste of time, and I'm going home.
Can they not be separate but connected? Do they have to be either continuous or completely discontinuous?
Well, yes, but I mean, what do you mean, sort of faintly tenuously connected or something? Or
no, all degrees in between is what I mean.
Metaphysics is meta-science.
Hold on, wait, hold your turn. This has stirred up some questions. No, David is first, then Jean, and then Ivor. Okay, so then Intra, and then the guy there. Okay, so did you finish your remark?
Quite a clarification, quick.
You said a priori for both one and two.
Yeah. Yes, but in rather different senses. Where one sort of grand, I mean, a priori.
Okay, it's enough just to know that you meant a priori for both. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yes, one in the grand sense and one in the more
Sense. Right, David.
This hasn't got anything to do with what we've just been talking about.
Can you hold off then, because we've still got quarter of an hour. Okay, so let's finish this strand, and then you're after this strand. We're trying to. So, Jean.
Can you get that to Jean? Litchfield
Cathedral. Now I know why this job's only for 2 years.
I was just thinking back to what I said about the matter of intention is not something science can study. It is inherently not something science can study, but it is something about which you can frame metaphysical theories which are useful. So that would be my reply.
My challenge is, sort of, what's the authority for what you're going to tell me about
these things. I mean, are you going to make up a story and then I'm going to make up a counter story?
We each have our own authority as far as I can
see. Oh, right, so we can't adjudicate between them.
Well, so it's argued out, isn't it? It's argued out over the centuries.
Relative?
What does psychology do then?
But it's argued out. Philosophers have been arguing over the centuries, and that will continue. And philosophy has a history, and the history informs what goes after it. And otherwise, we repeat it, you know, pointlessly. So, you know, I would say that there is a place for what I call metaphysics, which is not science, can't be science. And what's the other thing you said? Oh, pointless. I can't remember your
name. Well, sort of just analysing language.
Yeah,
or
and it's not that either.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean,
if we say, well, presumably either Aristotle or Leibniz was the better metaphysician, how would we decide between them? Who is the best and why?
I don't think we do that. I think what we do is we look at life and we frame, for instance, Kant talks about freedom. I think freedom is very relevant. I think that, okay? You may not, but I do. And I will put my ideas and you will put yours and other people will ultimately, as philosophy progresses, decide from them.
How does it progress? We're just putting our views. I mean,
that's what we do in the history of science.
So do you think it is there must be a part of sociology, which is one of the options here?
No, sociology is different.
It's not going to progress unless someone backs down and says, I think you're right and I'm wrong.
Oh, I think this happens. Usually what happens is they die. and their followers don't follow.
Not somebody if I die, doesn't
so,
mean
so
wrong.
And other people live and their followers do follow. I think that's how it happens.
It might be that someone comes up with a better argument, which may not be scientific argument.
Right.
At all, and it may be that if we would have a brilliant mind that comes up with an argument so good. So yes, of course, that's right.
Well, that's sort of what I'm interested in. I mean, what do the arguments look like? I mean, presumably these are reasons for believing things. So the question is, what sort of reasons can you put forward that will adjudicate those kind of huge sort of abstract issues? I mean, are there solid reasons where everyone says, oh yes, that's a really good reason?
Evidence,
yes, but what sort of evidence? Empirical evidence? I mean, scientists have grabbed all that.
It might be an argument, say, from a mind experiment or something like that. I mean, a good mind could come up with something that might be very creative.
Right, so the thought experiment, imaginative experiment.
Yes, yeah. They're quite likely. And someone says, oh, yes, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And it seems to. It's hard to refute. It happens all the time. People always coming up with good arguments that aren't necessarily scientific. Nothing to do with physics.
Definitely, you come down to intuition.
No. An argument is either good or bad. It doesn't have to be scientific.
That's a very interesting thing. But I think Ivor's got some burning points to make. But we really need
to argue. I want to come back to a priori. Because I think metaphysics is about the real world. Which makes it empirical.
Well, that means you're voting for my second account, that it's not.
Well, you describe.
It's continuous.
But you describe your second account as a priori, though.
No,
it's truly wrong.
No, sorry, let me read. Let further clarification. I'm saying there's. One, metaphysics is either separate from science or continuous. If it's separate from science, then it falls into two groups. Which are both a priori, where one, the big, grand a priori insight into reality, the other, the lesser a priori knowledge of analytic truths. And those are the two separate ones. And then the other story, you know, there's 1A, 1B, and 2. 2 is continuous with science. And that, I take it, well, I don't think it's a priori, because it's rooted in empirical knowledge, but it's sort of. Like theoretical physics or something.
Isness and aboutness, where science hasn't managed to go.
Yes, but as long as presumably, I take it that second version is answerable to science. Let's put it that way.
Experimental metaphysics.
But it might still be a priori.
Experimental metaphysics, maybe.
Which is
experimental metaphysics.
When I'm defending this rather than attacking it, I like to say that scientists are my servants. they're out there sort of checking the facts for me to make sure we get the metaphysics right. You know. But I'm not sure about that. I really am the metaphysics. Lacking confidence about.
I would second that actually.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right. I'm right. Right. Well,
okay.
Yeah. That's my view.
Is it? Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But I think that the metaphysicians and the physicists are often the same person. They do both jobs.
Yeah.
And Einstein and Dirac and Heisenberg, Max Darwin, all these guys are examples of that. Are we finished that particular discussion then? So you wanted to start a new thread?
I don't mean to.
Oh, right. Well, shout. Come on. Just talk normally.
This is a question I'd like to put to Eileen, and maybe you, Mike. And I am feeling slightly intellectually punch drunk at the moment, so it may not come over as well as I'd hoped. What is it about Aristotle that makes it okay to speculate about the fact that he may have not been Alexander's tutor, but somebody else's, Xerxes, for example? And yet jokey, in a sense, to talk about him being a paperclip. Is there a sort of hierarchy of criterial attributes here?
I want to answer that.
Anybody who...
I throw that question open. I'd rather see what people think about that. And then, I'll come back and take your
writing. Right behind you, Eileen. David was roaring to go on that one.
Yeah, well... I can't find
my question.
It was the point that you made right at the end, which was you said that you said that if a material object is an essential kind, we can't exclude Aristotle because he too is a material object, in which case he could still be a paperclip. Now the point about that is that there's a hierarchy of kinds, isn't there? A material object is a big group, and people and paperclips are smaller groups. And so therefore Aristotle belongs both to material kinds and to human beings and philosophers and to people called Aristotle. And all those different categories he applies to, and they don't apply to so you have the choice about what your categorization is, what these instances
that's the issue.
Are.
Do you have a choice about categorization? Now, sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't.
Right,
and I think that's the issue.
Yes.
Now, with the natural kinds, I think people would say you don't have that much of a choice. What you have a choice about, you can have a choice in classification. Biologists get very muddled about this. They confuse what a thing is from how you classify it, because you can classify things in so many different ways. And so, I mean, biologists probably need metaphysics more than any other scientist, I think. But you're quite right. The more you get away from the natural, the more human interests come into the classification, and it gets very, very muddy. So, what was your question? I mean, you've got to separate. I've just got one thing to say. Separate what a thing is from how you classify it. They're separate issues. Okay, that's
right.
All.
So what constitutes what a thing is? Is there something a thing might lack and then find itself not that thing at all?
Yeah, well...
So what are the criteria for...
You want your description before you've got the thing. You've got to start with the things. I think that's what Aristotle would do. I don't know.
You
start with the thing. You look at the things around you and you start your categorization from them. And then your categorizations get more and more abstract as you go up.
So the attributes you need to classify them depend on the classes you're talking about.
I mean...
Well, that's actually the answer I would have given if somebody had asked me that question. Yes, I agree.
Okay.
So in a way, you're just starting off with, ostensive...
You start off with ostensive definition or a surrogate of that. and you say, you know, that look like little kids do, you know, when you teach your little, you know, when you tell your children from a picture book what these things are, and they're a mix, of course, of natural artifacts.
So we end up really, and I don't think it's a bad thing to end up with things like this and that, which Russell, I think, gave as a criterion for what monads might be.
Yeah, except Russell got very sceptical, didn't he? And this and that ended up not referring to objects, but referring to his own sense datum. And no one can really quite make sense of
that. I think what they referred to is what exists, and then the second step was that the only thing that exists is his sense datum.
Basically, you can't know objects directly, is what he would say. I think I want to deny that, but it's. Anyway.
I think it's enough just to say this or that.
Yeah.
But you're pointing at an object.
And that's our starting point for all our knowledge of the world. I mean, cognitive psychology, doesn't it confirm that, you know, children start individuating objects and groups of objects before they think about properties? I mean, kids don't start to learn the language for properties until they've got quite a grasp of different kinds of things. Things are ontologically prior, and that's why I think subject, predicate, structure of language. That is just top of head.
I just wanted to
say we've run out of time, so David.
Yeah, okay, just only you say children categorise things before they understand category properties, but that's just the nature of humans. In our ability to make categorisations, to identify properties without having the concept of properties. The concept of properties comes after, because it's analytic on what you do.
Yeah.
So in other words, say a dog knows how to move its feet without having a concept of foot.
Of course.
So your argument about children doesn't bear any relation to the problem, which is that we categorise just because that's in our nature to categorise.
That's fine. I'm happy with that.
No,
I'll agree with that.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Let's pass
the roving mic.
Is
everyone talking about
that? I only want to say I will only be satisfied with this conversation when I heard the term
region.
That was
all too.
I thought that
you were
looking at Russell, you said the only region designated was this.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
And
are
that?
We. Ah, we still have some steam over here. Yeah. Right. Oh, well, look, let Peter go first, because the mic's already there.
Can I just say on the subject of whether Aristotle would be a paper to it, I can't make any sense of the question other than... Sorry, it's too... I can't make any sense of answering that question other than by saying, well, what is the essence of Aristotle? I mean, if you think of some continuum that goes from Aristotle to a paper clip, long before you get to the paper clip, you'll say, well, this obviously isn't Aristotle. So there's got to be some sort of...
Why obviously?
Yeah. Well, I'm taking it as being obvious that Aristotle can't be a paper clip. Because, I mean, if I encounter a paperclip and you tell me this is Aristotle, I'm just saying, it isn't.
Well, Aristotle makes some things further up the hierarchy. Some things obvious.
It must be obvious where that point comes from. It would be obvious if it happened at some point.
Somewhere in the
hierarchy. Well, I mean, if you're not prepared to accept it all as obvious that Aristotle is a paperclip, then we probably... I'll have to talk to the other people. I
can't
say much, really.
Yes, but what I'm asking, I think it is obvious that Aristotle's not a paperclip, but what I want to know is what that obviousness consists in.
I'm interested in what that obviousness consists in, because
it's very difficult to
find. The fact that you just say it's obvious just seems to repeat the question.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't finished. What I'm saying is if we agree that it's obvious that Aristotle is not a paperclip, and we do,
right, that if you think of a continuum of things, Aristotle morphing into something sort of slightly smaller, he turns into a woman, and then he becomes, I don't know, etc., etc. Then he becomes, sort of hat stands comes here, right? But it just seems to be obvious that in this continuum, you've got to say, well, could Aristotle be an inch taller? Could he be a fishmonger? Could he be, sort of much stronger than he was, etc.? Yes, he could. And then, could he have been a woman? You can argue over the details of what the cut-off point is. All I'm saying is there must be some cut-off point where you're going to say, well, that's obviously not Aristotle.
This must.
And that can only be answered, deciding that cut-off, by examining Aristotle as we understand him to be and saying the essence of this person is that he's got to be like that.
Right.
This thing has lost what I judge to be essential to that. If you don't have that, then Aristotle will be a patient.
But is this must a metaphysical must, a logical must, a lazy person's must?
Now,
we have reached the cut-off point here. Okay. Now, we are at the cut-off point. And I'm going to allow another minute or two. So two more questions. So one from Mike, and then one Peggy, isn't it?
Jenny.
One from Jenny, and then that's it. And then one final announcement.
Can't put my point in 1 minute.
Right? Okay, right. So Jenny, and then sorry, David, going to cut you off. You'll be the cop.
My point is just a simple one, which is that there aren't any necessary or sufficient conditions for deciding at what point what defines Aristotle or anything else, in fact.
There was a moment at which Aristotle was named. That's the cut-off point. Okay,
so you've had the final word, but that makes a good discussion. The bar will be open until 10:30. It's now 9:00. So I've got two things to say before I go. So thank you all very much for coming along and helping me make this a very successful day. So thank you very much. And thank you very much to the speakers who've done so much work.
And to you.
Thank you. And then one last thing. Would you please leave your badge? Mine's called Aristotle. Would you leave it on the back here so that we don't have to buy more next year, and it will save enough to buy two or three people a drink?
I wonder where I left my papers.
We also thank you very much.